4 o'clock today, Estes will tell us about his travels and his study, and we'll talk about the year that he spent in Iran under a Fulbright-Hayes grant. He was there, by the way, at the time of the revolution. Every Wednesday on Fresh Air at 3:30, Francis Davis reviews new jazz releases. Today we'll hear a new anthology of pianists called I Remember Bebop. At 3 o'clock today, my guest will be Terry Fox. She's a Philadelphia-based dancer who performs in lofts and performance spaces around the city. One of her special interests has been using non-dancers as well as dancers within her performances. Terry has also been an important force in the organization Old City Arts. We'll talk about her approach to dance when she joins us. Question: what link can you find between the campaigns of Bill Green, Ed Koch, Ella Grasso, and John Anderson? Well, the answer is they've all had the same media advisor and political advisor, David Garth. Political consultants like Garth are nowadays being credited for the success when their candidate gets elected. Sidney Blumenthal writes that these political consultants are the new power within the American political system. Consultants have replaced party bosses. Media savvy has replaced the patronage system of getting out the vote. Sidney Blumenthal is with me now to discuss the subject of his new book, The Permanent Campaign, Inside the World of Elite Political Operatives. The book is published by the Beacon Press. Blumenthal writes for The Real Paper in Boston, and he's also written for The Boston Globe, The Nation, In These Times, and Mother Jones. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Who are these political consultants that you're writing about?
Well, maybe it's in a way to start, it would be interesting to contrast them to the Madison Avenue advertising executives. I mean, the common perception of political advertising is selling candidates like soap. And you think of an advertising campaign, you think of an advertising executive, some kind of slick character. But the political consultants really differ from the Madison Avenue people. They are people who come out of political backgrounds. They have political savvy. They are people who not only have this kind of political knowledge, but also have the new modern skills that are necessary in order to wage political campaigns. That is, they know how to make television commercials. They can work with videotape. They can work with film. They understand polling. They can work with computers. They understand direct mail, and so on. So they're very different, and perhaps as a way to understand it, you can go back to the 1968 campaign between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. And out of that campaign emerged a book by Joe McGinnis called The Selling of the President. And it was a revealing account of Richard Nixon's campaign in which Nixon's image had been molded by a Madison Avenue approach. And he had been portrayed in this antiseptic, sterile way. Whereas the Humphrey campaign was really overlooked. Yet the Humphrey campaign, in a lot of ways, was the innovative campaign. That was the new campaign, the new mode of politics. Humphrey was an old-fashioned candidate. He didn't mesh at all with his media advisors. And his top advisor was a guy named Joe Napolitan, who incidentally urged Humphrey to break with Johnson on the war. And Napolitan told me, he said, unfortunately, Hubert suffered from a fatal disease known as loyalty. And he couldn't break with Johnson. But Napolitan was a new-style political consultant, someone who had a political background and yet understood film, television, and so on.
So when a political consultant gets together with a candidate, to what extent do you think the consultant advises the candidate on what the policy should be? In other words, are we getting the policy of the political consultant who the candidate is paying for when someone's running for office?
Well, a political consultant advises a candidate in different ways than we might think of a political advisor advising a candidate. A political consultant has the aura of science around him. He's got a certain magical wand that the candidate believes he can wave over him and transform into a prince, even if he's a frog. So, what does the consultant show the candidate? Importantly, consultant will show the candidate polls. And these are not the kinds of polls that you're going to see in the Bulletin or the Inquirer. These are very sophisticated, detailed polls that have been run through computers, which show exactly what the weaknesses of the candidate are, what his strengths are, what the weaknesses and strengths of his opponent are, on all sorts of issues, including issues that don't come up in the campaign, like personality traits. Is he trustworthy? And the consultant, using a pollster or if he's a pollster himself, can understand what the intensity of feeling is on all these issues. And he will then advise the candidate, for instance, which issues will work best for him and appeal to which constituency, and how saying certain things in a certain way will move a certain audience in a certain way, and how the themes of the campaign, as they unreal on television, can establish his image and win him the 51% of the market share that he needs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, you say in your book that this system of having political advisors has basically replaced the system of party bosses. Make that comparison for us.
Consider this. Let's start at the presidential level, because I think that's where it's most significant. When a man was running for president and he was selected by his party to be the nominee, he had made alliances and deals with the party bosses in order to get there. They knew who he was. And even if he was not one of them, like Jack Kennedy was not one of the party bosses, they still trusted him. They understood that he understood. And therefore, when he assumed office, he would govern with them. They would govern in tandem. There was no separation or split between governing and campaigning. Now, there's a deep split. And what happens is, with the decline of political parties for a whole host of reasons, and with the ascendance of the political consultants who are a different kind of party boss, what you have are candidates seeking the presidency who don't have to win the loyalty of the party bosses to get the nomination. What they have to do is to wage campaigns of symbols and images created by political consultants in order to go through 37 primaries, a general election. I mean, what is in effect a long television season? I mean, you have, a 14-week TV series with the primary season, and then you have big events with the conventions, to the conclusion. It's sort of like, a mini-series at the end. And you need the political consultant in order to run that campaign. But when you get into office, you don't have that base of support and that network of alliances that runs deep into the population. It runs deep into the constituencies that you used to have. And so there's a split between campaigning and governing. How do you govern then? You have to govern in many ways in the same way in which you campaigned, what I call the permanent campaign. You continue to use symbols and images once you are in office. And so the kind of politician that's produced under this new mode differs sharply from the kind of politician that was produced under the old mode of political parties.
No, one thing that, for instance, a president has to do is to be convincing to the Congress. Now, how can you use symbols and images on that level of getting your support? Because it's different than going out to the voters.
Well, that's right. I mean, Tip O'Neill is no political consultant. There's a real contempt on the part of some candidates and politicians for the traditional ways of doing things. I know Ham Jordan never returned phone calls from people. He just made a point of not doing that. And I quote him in my book as saying, people say to him, well, why is Congress so alienated from you? And Jordan says, it's not that they're alienated from me. It's that I'm alienated from them, and I don't care to deal with them. So they ride the phantom of public opinion as opposed to the traditional constituencies and the traditional institutional ways of proceeding once you're elected.
Let's look at another aspect of the changeover, as you describe it, from a political patronage system and party bosses to this political advisor system. Usually there was a whole system within the party to get out the vote. Local people would come knocking on your door and ask if you needed anything. This, of course, never happened in my neighborhood. Yeah. I don't know. But ask if you needed anything, whatever, and urge you to come out and support the candidate that they were supporting. And you suggest now that it's actually much more that the media is getting out the vote through these ads, and that a lot of the attention is being aimed not necessarily at the people of the party, but at the uncommitted people, which is a large percentage of the American population.
Well, that's right. Instead of the political parties mobilizing the voters, television mobilizes the voters, which has, in part, been one of the reasons that the political consultants have been called into existence in the first place. They're needed in order to mobilize the voters. You have to go through the tube. I mean, instead of having precinct captains, as you point out, you now have political commercials. The political commercials are, in effect, the substitute for the armies of precinct captains. But there's a big difference. There's no human link there. There's no obligation involved. There's no quid pro quo involved in watching a television commercial. However, if your street is fixed because you went to the precinct captain who lived in your neighborhood, you may feel an obligation to vote for the candidate he tells you to vote for. But that whole system is in decay. It's in decline. It's an obsolescent system. Instead, you have this ascendant system of what I call the permanent campaign. And what's arisen instead is what you point out, which is this growing mass of disorganized, alienated voters.
Well, do you think that it's unfortunate that we don't have that system anymore? Because there's so much potential there for corruption and for graft and manipulation.
I'm not nostalgic for the old political system. I mean, on the other hand, I'm not, completely approving of the new mode. What I'm interested in doing is analyzing this. I mean, many columnists and political observers now, with the end of the primary system, have posed the question, why do we have candidates with whom perhaps the majority of the voters are unhappy about? I mean, they're unhappy with the choices with which they're presented. And some political observers say what we need to do is to return to the kind of political system we used to have, where the party bosses would pick the candidates. And then instead of having Carter and Reagan, we would have had, say, Mondale and Baker. And this is a much more reasonable choice. I know David Broder of the Washington Post suggests this. And my feeling is that that's a thoroughly nostalgic point of view, and that it sort of shows an inability to face up to the new reality. And what my book tries to point out is that that whole system has been superseded, and that what we have is an entirely new reality of politics, and that if one wants to deal with it, the first step is understanding it.
In another issue that you bring up in your book is that the political consultants are the permanent people, and it's the candidates who shuffle around and who are ephemeral. Is that really true, do you think?
Yes. In the same way the party bosses were permanent and the candidates were ephemeral in the old days. But the world of political consultants is like a small town, and they all know each other. It's a very small group of people. And, consider this. Now, David Garth may do a campaign for, let's say, Bill Green. But he also might do a campaign for Richard Thornburg, which he's done. And in that campaign, he could work with a consultant whose name is John Deardorff. And Deardorff is a leading Republican consultant. But in Venezuela, Garth may work for a candidate for president of Venezuela against a candidate who is advised by John Deardorff. And Deardorff, meanwhile, who was running the campaign of Howard Baker for president, was relying on polls for his candidate for president of Venezuela from Pat Cadell, who he's ostensibly running against for president, who's advising Jimmy Carter. And these sort of peregrinations really continue ad infinitum. There are enormous interconnections, and the consultants are the ones, therefore, who control the contacts in politics increasingly. They have the connections, and they're the ones who know the intimate histories of the campaigns. They are the ones who then establish the standards of professionalism that the candidates who are emerging have to learn how to live up to. So a new kind of candidate emerges, a new kind of politics emerges.
Now, you've talked a little bit about some of the ads that could be devised by one of these image makers, but a lot of what we learn about candidates we learn through the news, whether it's on television, in an interview on the Today Show, or at a feature on what the candidate said today on the 6:30 news, or in the newspaper, an article by a reporter who's covering the beat. Do you think that there's ways that the political consultants can manipulate the way we see something in the news, or what becomes the news?
Well, the way in which they conceive of news is as free media. What's called what we call advertising, they don't call advertising. Sometimes they do, but what they really call it is paid media. What you do in your paid media is that you establish your themes, the themes that you've set in your campaign. Let's say, here's a famous slogan about some candidates that David Garth came up with, a very famous slogan. He says, they're young, they're tough, and nobody owns them. Great slogan, all right? Now, those are your themes, okay? Now, through the paid media and commercials and slogans and all kinds of things, you establish that.
Did David Garth come up with that?
Yeah, David Garth and Elliot Kersen.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought Elliot Kersen came up with it. Yeah.
Elliot told me the story. They were sitting around one day.
Yeah, good, tell it.
They wanted to establish these themes, that they weren't corrupt, that they were young, but also that they were tough. In other words, they were liberals, you see, but they were law and order liberals, you see. So what do you do? So you've got those themes. You need a slogan. Say, they're young, they're tough, and nobody's bought them, or nobody can corrupt them, or then just kick it around for a while until you come up with something musical. So that's how that kind of slogan is invented.
Let me just reintroduce you for our listeners who are just tuning in. I'm speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, and we're talking about political advisors, media advisors, to people who are running campaigns. And he's written a book called The Permanent Campaign, Inside the World of Elite Political Operatives. And the book features interviews with a lot of different media advisors who have advised presidential candidates and other key people. Let's talk about David Garth, who's one of the major political advisors, and he advised Bill Green here in Philadelphia, Ella Grasso. You said he worked with Thornburg for a while.
With Thornburg, he has worked. His closest relationship is with Hugh Carey, the governor of New York. He's elected the president of Venezuela. He's worked in many, many campaigns. Garth is almost a parody of himself. Garth, in fact, was parodied in the movie The Candidate, where the political consultant is based on him. And Garth is really a character. There's no other way of putting it. He thinks like Machiavelli, and he looks like Edward G. Robinson, and he talks like Damon Runyon, and he's deliberately has this sort of streetwise attitude. And he's extremely shrewd. He's very clever, and he possesses a great deal of political savvy.
What does he want to know about a candidate before he's willing to back them, because I'm sure he won't be an advisor to just anyone who can pay
some
him.
Candidates. Garth told me the story of one candidate in New York who walked in his office and said, here's $250,000. I'm going to run for office, and I want you to create a campaign so that I can get elected. And Garth threw the guy out. Garth did not suffer this fool gladly. Garth wants to work with a client who can use the technology and who fits Garth's bill of what a client should be, and that's very personal as opposed to ideological. Garth crosses party lines. He works for all sorts of candidates, but he has to feel good personally about it, and that's very interesting because that means that the consultant in some way acts as the pre-selector. He acts as the nominating process in himself, because if you say that you have David Garth as your consultant, that means a great deal to people who give money to campaigns. It gives you instant credibility with the press. It means that you are a serious candidate. And it puts you on the ballot very quickly.
Well, he's now John Anderson's advisor. Do you think that teaming up with him has made Anderson more of a serious candidate?
Well, I think yes and no. I think the Anderson campaign is perhaps the purest expression of the permanent campaign. And by that I mean, if you don't look at John Anderson's ideology and you look at his methodology, see, what you see is this. You see a man who is without a party, a man whose base consists of a disorganized mass of voters, the alienated voters, the independent voters, who are growing and growing and growing. Anderson doesn't have an organization. He disdains the idea of organizing a third party. What is his party, then? It consists of David Garth and a direct mail firm which raises $50,000 a day for him in order to sustain that campaign. In short, John Anderson's campaign is media and money. That's what it is. And in order to win, what he seeks to do, what he must seek to do, is to destroy political parties, to destroy people's loyalties, to increase disintegration, to increase fragmentation, regardless of his intent or his motives or what he wants to accomplish. That's the function and structure of his political campaign. Permanent campaign.
Now, this is interesting because the image he seems to me to be trying to present is almost one of a renegade. He's parted company with both parties. He's a free thinker and independent. And if you identify with him, you're a free thinker and independent. But what you're saying is, in a way, a vote for him is a vote for a new kind of machine, the media.
No, a new kind of non-machine.
New kind of non-machine, that's right, which you see as being equally disturbing and lopsided as the machine is, but different.
It's not the harbinger of the end of political parties. It is the end of political parties. And this is it. I mean, you have to understand the John Anderson candidacy in this way, that Anderson has shown how you can put together a presidential campaign without a political party. And regardless of how he acted in the primaries, the effect of what he did in his primaries was simply to gain public visibility and name identification and media exposure so that he could run this kind of campaign. And Anderson even has transcended the primary system. He's just used it in this kind of media-based way so that not only is the old party system obsolescent, but the primary system in some ways is obsolescent if you're willing to transcend the party itself. Now, consider this. What if Teddy Kennedy were not a party loyalist? Couldn't he run for president with a political consultant? He'd probably have a bigger base than John Anderson. And what about the New Right? Why couldn't they put together a presidential campaign? What you could have, and what we may see in November, if we have a deadlock and it's thrown into the House of Representatives, is a parliamentary reality, a multi-party system, which is based on personalities, in a non-parliamentary constitutional structure. And what you do is that you add deadlock to checks and balances. It's a total impasse of democracy.
Let's look a little bit more at Anderson's campaign. What can you see in his campaign that you know is the doing of David Garth?
Well, when Garth runs a campaign, he controls all aspects of that campaign. He controls the advertising, the interpretation of the polls, the themes that are set, the candidate's scheduling, and often some of the issues that the candidate selects to stress.
Have you seen any advertisements that that strike you as being
typical? Well, he hasn't done any ads for Anderson yet. He's moved Anderson around in front of certain kinds of audiences where he gets network exposure or local media exposure in such a way that it's beneficial to the Anderson candidacy, whether it's in front of a Jewish group to allay their suspicions about Anderson's born-again past, or whether it's a black group to show that he understands black concerns or whatever. I mean, that's Garth's doing. You see Garth in the back of the hall or one of his operatives. I mean, there's no question. Anderson can't do that on his own, although Anderson himself, I know Anderson, is very much attuned to the importance of media. And if you look at the difference between Anderson and Phil Crane, another Republican who was very low in the polls, you see how their candidacies move very differently. And the reason is that the national press picked up on John Anderson. And that had more to do with Anderson's attitude toward the press and his understanding of how you cultivate it than it did necessarily with, say, Crane's conservatism, which some members of the National Press Corps might not have found appealing. Hmm. So Anderson himself understands this very well. In fact, I had a conversation with Anderson about the disturbing aspects of this whole kind of system, and he understands it and perhaps wants to use the permanent campaign against the permanent campaign.
Do you believe that?
I think he thinks that, yeah. But I don't know what the outcome is, because I believe often that form determines content and that style is substance. So that's a problem for him. It's ironical and paradoxical, and that's a big problem for John Anderson. What's he trying to do? I mean, regardless of what issues he's stressing.
Let's look at Kennedy for a little bit here. Now, his popularity base seems to have fallen apart during the course of the primaries. He did terribly almost every place. Do you blame that at all on the media advisor that he had?
No, the lack of media advisors. Kennedy's campaign was a case study in misunderstanding media. And Kennedy was the kind of... I mean, a lot of people talk about Kennedy as representing the old-fashioned liberalism. But what... I mean, that may be true. But what Kennedy also represents is the old-fashioned politics. Before he announced, we thought, Carter can't stand a chance against the Kennedy juggernaut. He's going to roll right over him. But Kennedy, unlike Carter, didn't understand the permanent campaign. He didn't understand how to coordinate all its elements. He didn't understand that you need a media consultant to really take control and coordinate your polling with your advertising and all those sorts of things that a consultant does. So Kennedy instead brought in Herb Schmertz, the Mobil Oil vice president, who's head of public relations. And Schmertz tried to create a fable of Teddy Kennedy, just like there are fables for Mobil Oil. But Schmertz didn't understand political media. There's a big difference between political media and corporate media. Schmertz thinks that you use polls to confirm your own attitudes. He doesn't understand that you use polls to learn what it is that the public is thinking and what different segments of the public are thinking and how they're moving and what the deeper tendencies are and how they're moving about things that you wouldn't consider to be issues, like questions of trust. Schmertz thought, I know what the issues are, it's inflation. See? But it turned out not to be inflation for Teddy Kennedy. By the time that Teddy Kennedy got it together, which was just before Pennsylvania, his campaign had already lost. He was already a defeated candidate.
In almost every clip that I heard of Kennedy when he was traveling around the country, he was either talking about inflation, but even more than that, he was talking about how Carter wouldn't debate him. Do you think if he had a better media advisor that he wouldn't have been repeating that, or do you think that that was, from an image point of view, a good thing to be doing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, by that time, Kennedy had already lost. If he had started out his campaign in a consistent, coordinated... I mean, if any candidate could have benefited from a media consultant, regardless of all their drawbacks, it was Teddy Kennedy. He failed to communicate his message to the voters. Absolutely. Instead, as soon as he got off the mark, he was shot down by that Roger Mudd interview, then by Jimmy Carter, and then by the Ayatollah. And Carter went straight at him with these indirect negative ads, stressing Carter's positive virtues, which were also Kennedy's liabilities. And Kennedy never recovered. He only started doing well in the primaries when he became a protest candidate, when people began to feel that Carter's inevitable nomination was something that they couldn't cope with. They couldn't accept this. And so they started voting for Kennedy, even though they still didn't trust him. And by that time, it was too late for Teddy.
Let's look at someone who's been very successful, Ronald Reagan. Now, you describe him as being a created politician. What do you mean?
Well, Ronald Reagan was created by a political consulting firm in the same way that as an actor he was created by a Hollywood studio. When Ronald Reagan entered politics, he had never held office before. He had no political experience except if you consider giving speeches at banquets for General Electric political experience. What could he do? In 1964, he gave a speech for Barry Goldwater, and it attracted the attention of certain wealthy Republican backers who needed someone to step into this vacuum that had been created by the Republican defeat. They wanted Reagan. They went to the leading Californian who was a political consultant, Stuart Spencer. Stuart Spencer turned all of Reagan's liabilities into assets. If Reagan was inexperienced, then he would be billed as the citizen politician. It's the original outsider campaign that Jimmy Carter later ran on. The outsider will come in and throw all the rascals out. The insiders are the ones who have mucked things up. Is Reagan an actor? Do people distrust actors? Well, we'll make his ads deliberately artless. They'll just be sort of crude. I mean, just people will think, this guy's not slick, he's honest. And that was all a very calculated effort. Spencer hired two behavioral psychologists to help frame Reagan's responses to questions on the issues. Reagan wrote them all down on index cards, the beginning of Ronald Reagan's famous index cards. You know, he carries them everywhere on all issues and reads from them. And it's part of his standard speech, which he almost never varies, except when he makes errors. And Reagan was elected twice on the basis of Stuart Spencer's consulting work.
Now, who has been his consultant for the campaign, the primaries?
Well, his consultant in this campaign has been John Sears.
But he fired Sears, didn't he, in the middle
fired
of
the Sears
primaries?
The day of the New Hampshire primary. Sears had advised Reagan not to appear in Iowa, which had hurt Reagan, and Reagan lost to Bush in Iowa. Republicans, you know, have a sense of fair play that's evidences itself strangely at times, and they felt that Reagan's reluctance to appear was somehow unfair, and so they punished him. And Reagan, very unsure of himself, fired Sears the day of the New Hampshire primary, which was his huge triumph and in effect sealed the nomination for him. He simply coasted to victory after that on the basis of Sears's strategy of positioning himself in the middle while relying on that same hard core of conservative Republican support. It was a very intelligent strategy, and Sears is generally acknowledged to be the smartest of Republican consultants. So Reagan is coasted up to this point, and now Reagan is hired to do his media a man named Peter Daly, who most people never heard of. But Peter Daly was the head of what was called the November Group in 1972. What is the November Group? The November Group ran the political advertising for the committee to reelect the president, and the president in question being Richard Nixon. And so Reagan has now hired Peter Daly to construct his image in the 1980 campaign. And maybe in a way this is Reagan's idea of party loyalty, of returning to someone who had done Republican presidential politics before.
Do you think that's going to be a good choice for him?
Well, Daly is widely respected by people, and it's generally acknowledged that that campaign he ran for Nixon, whatever you thought of Nixon or the campaign, was highly professional.
Let's see, the latest thing from Reagan that really sticks out in my mind is his pledge that if he turns senile, he'll step down from the presidency.
Well, I thought that was proof itself.
Do you think an advisor suggested that he say that?
Well, Reagan has a number of problems, and this is actually a subject away from political consultants and into the field of advisors. I just did a 10,000-word piece for the Boston Globe magazine on Reagan's advisors. And Reagan indeed has problems with his campaign, which may show up later in the race. Yesterday, I spent the morning with Pat Caddell, and we talked about it. And there's a feeling in the Carter camp that that Reagan's campaign is a little bit out of control now, and that they don't understand the difference between a general and a primary election, and the question of timing, which is very important, and that could hurt Reagan a lot. I mean, Reagan is going to be up in the polls the day after the Democratic convention, and he's going to immediately become the issue. And it's going to be a question of how quickly he's driven down again. Is he going to be driven down quickly enough by Election Day for Carter to triumph? And then, of course, there's the wild card factor of Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
But what in essence you have are three candidates running on variants of the permanent campaign.
Right. My guest is Sidney Blumenthal, if you're just joining us, and he's a writer. He writes for The Real Paper and for In These Times and Mother Jones, and we're talking about the subject of his book, The Permanent Campaign, which is about media and political advisors to political candidates. Okay, Carter is the person who's left who we must deal with. We've talked about him a little bit, but I'd like to get into this a little more. Now, his advisor has been Gerald Rafshoon.
Gerald Rafshoon is his media advisor. Rafshoon is someone who was an Atlanta advertising executive. He was not from the largest firm in Atlanta, but he had a very good client, someone who had become governor of Georgia and who decided to run for president. So Rafshoon rose to the purple with Jimmy Carter. Rafshoon's sensibility is no different from that of someone from a provincial capital who has emerged into the limelight. Patrick Cadell, on the other hand, is someone who has a profound grasp of politics, who not only understands the technology, but has a certain vision of politics. It happens to be a deeply pessimistic vision, but he does have a vision of politics. And Rafshoon's work generally unreels out of Cadell's polls. And Cadell has a strange relationship with the Georgian circle as well. Sometimes they let him in, and sometimes they keep him out, because he's really not one of them. And that's a very tightly held circle. But Cadell is absolutely essential to the continued operation of the Carter campaign and the Carter candidacy and the Carter presidency.
Can you give us some of the specifics that you think they've provided for him in terms of his image, or his policy, the timing of his statements?
Well, Cadell's whole career has been based around the idea of alienation, which is the whole question of independent voters, of disintegration in American politics. Cadell started out by looking at the Wallace voters and seeing them as alienated voters who needed to be won back to a candidate who would not be so threatening and might even be populist in a positive way. Cadell was looking for someone like that, and that candidate happened to be Jimmy Carter, the moderate New South candidate, who would win the Wallace constituency and essentially, Cadell hoped, solve the problem of alienation. However, the way in which Carter waged his campaign, using Cadell's methods, only rode the waves of alienation. I mean, like so many consultants, Cadell swims in the sea of alienation, in the sea of independent voters. And once in office, Carter faced perpetual personal crises over sustaining his popularity, which was often confused with legitimacy. The key case in question was the case of Jimmy Carter going to the mountaintop at Camp David over the energy question. There were long gas lines last summer. There was violence out here in Levittown. First gas riot in American history. Energy crisis seemed to be insoluble. What was Carter going to do? Carter at the time was sailing down the Mississippi on a steamboat. Then he went to Japan for an economic summit. When he came back, he was faced with a crisis. Not only a crisis involving the question of energy, but a crisis involving his continuation of his presidency, a crisis of popularity, a crisis of direction. What was he going to do? Pat Cadell had been working for months on this, preparing 100-page memos, which he was giving to Roslyn, who is the important conduit, which is the right angle of entry into Jimmy Carter's mind, about the new nature of alienation and disenchantment, which Cadell called malaise. A malaise had overtaken the nation. How could we deal with it? And as a result of Cadell's prodding, Carter went into seclusion at Camp David and had a parade of wise men march past him and so on. And he emerged and he gave a big statement in which he talked about the whole question of malaise. Paragraphs of that speech, of which were lifted from speeches that Cadell had given even years ago about alienation. And Carter, in that speech, essentially blamed the problem on the spiritual condition of Americans. We were not willing to sacrifice. We were irresponsible. He wanted to elect a new people. And that was the message of that speech. And strangely enough, he shot up in the polls for a short period of time, and then he fired his cabinet. And that sunk him way down again, and that led almost directly into the beginnings of the Kennedy candidacy. Because at the same time, they were sure that Kennedy was going to run, and they felt that they needed someone to provide a contrast to Carter, even Kennedy, in order for Carter to triumph. The thinking was, Jimmy Carter cannot be elected unless he has opposition. And if it was going to be Kennedy, they understood that Kennedy did not understand the permanent campaign in the way they did. So they waved the red flag in front of Kennedy. Carter said, I'm going to whip Daddy Kennedy, and so on.
Oh, you see this as really being masterminded.
Absolutely.
And it worked, I guess, huh?
There's absolutely no question that all of this was thought out and was written down in memos, some of which were printed last week in the Washington Post.
Really? Why do you think that Kennedy's not giving in at this point?
Oh, I don't know. Irish stubbornness. He's defeated. Maybe he's thinking about 1984 and this whole period between now and the convention is a question of positioning him for the future. There must be things like that going on in his mind.
How do you grade the press in dealing with the permanent campaign? Do you think that many political correspondents and news commentators can see through a lot of this image creating that's happening? Are you satisfied with a lot of the editorials that have been written in major newspapers?
Well, I think that the general attitude that's taken is one of muckraking. And I think that's not really an analytical attitude. In other words, we're going to uncover the man behind the candidate and see how he's manipulating. It's sort of like saying the sky is blue. But what does this all mean? That's the important question. That's what I try and get at in the book. And I think that's generally not dealt with. The problem with the press is, and I don't mean this as a criticism necessarily, is that, because I'm a journalist myself, is that you're forced into a reactive role. You always have to respond to events. You have to respond to what people are doing. And so you're sort of forced to cover what you may even know to be a manipulative act on the part of a politician and present it as somehow a neutral objective occurrence. There's that whole problem. And I really don't buy the argument that it's the press which determines elections today. I think the press plays too much of a reactive role, and that the press essentially is played off of by politicians and consultants. And that argument, I think, fails to account for the consciousness of politics I call the permanent campaign, the politics of consultants.
Okay, well, you've just said that the big question here, which you don't feel is being adequately addressed in the press, is what is this going to mean for the future of politics in America? So let me throw that one back at you. What do you think it is going to mean? How is it going to affect the shape of politics and elections?
I think this is politics. This is not unreal. This is reality. And it's going to increasingly subsume all of politics. All major candidates are going to have to run with political consultants. This is going to be the mode of politics.
What's that going to mean, do you think, in terms of policies and how policies are drafted, how international affairs is handled?
I can't address the question of international affairs. However, the question of domestic affairs, it means increased fragmentation, increased susceptibility to pressure from small, single-issue groups. It means that you can't rely on that cohesive political party to sustain you, and therefore you're sort of out alone, and you hedge a lot. You'll hedge a lot. A candidate would hedge a lot more, would calculate his appeals much more carefully, and therefore depend much more on the tools of the political consultant. And so a whole new breed of politician emerges.
I have one last question for you. If I managed to convince David Garth that I was a good candidate, and if he was behind me, do you think I could win? In other words, what I'm really asking is not if you'd vote for me, but if you have to have something more than a good advisor behind you to win now. Do you think that we get any sense anymore of if a candidate really has depth and substance and a mind, the ability to think for himself, to influence people who need to be influenced? Or do you see the candidates now just being puppets?
Sure, it matters. And of course you would win,
too. Oh, you said the right thing.
Right.
So we still get a glimpse into the substance of the candidate, you think?
Well, it's not that the
candidate
consultant
still needs a brain.
It's not that the consultant wants to obscure the candidate and present a false image. It's that he wants to stress certain aspects of reality. For instance, David Garth.
I'm getting good at this.
David Garth, who you mentioned,
yeah,
will present the he tries to present TV commercials like news, and he wants to confuse you so that you think that what he's reporting about the candidate is the truth, and it is. It's true. So we'll have flashing across the screen, superimposed very rapidly, all the accomplishments of the candidate. Now, these might be minor bills a candidate has pushed through the state legislature, but they're all true. See, now that's not something that's false. That's part of something that's real. But that's something that he wants to stress, something he wants to use to enhance the candidate. You have to work with something that's substantial to begin with.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon. It's a very interesting analysis. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Terry.
I've been speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, and we've been talking about the subject of his new book, which is called The Permanent Campaign. And it's a book that analyzes the new approach to campaigning, image-making, with a lot of interviews featured with political advisors and media advisors who are the people behind the candidates and the men in office today. I'd like to mention that at 4 o'clock this afternoon, my guest will be Richard Estes, and he's done a pretty interesting study. He's traveled to many countries around the world and has tried to evaluate the social needs within different countries. This was a study that was done for an international organization that basically wants to evaluate how they can tell where social services are most needed and where their aid is most needed. Well, what Estes has found is that the gap between rich and poor countries is growing, and he feels that this is bound to bring more conflicts between rich and poor countries. And he thinks that a lot of the struggles that are happening within individual countries now, like the revolution in Iran, is really a manifestation of that conflict between rich and poor forces within the country. Well, he'll be sharing his analysis with us at 4 o'clock today. In about 5 minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be dancer Terry Fox, and we'll be talking about not only her dancing, but recent happenings in the Old City area, where she works out of. Then at 3:30, Frances Davis will be reviewing a new piano anthology called I Remember Bebop. So that's all coming up this afternoon on Fresh Air. Well, this is a duet between tenor saxophonist Buddy Tate with Jay McShann at the piano.